Scott would be a thinker. He loves big ideas and has never been accused of not having a strong enough opinion. Ryan, on the other hand, is a really great executor, which is why he naturally fit into the role of Chief Operating Officer, COO, at the community company. But our strengths intersect as enablers, which we can offer to our company and the organizations we have created in a very symbiotic way. Emotional intelligence. Now that you're self-aware and have figured out what kind of connector you are, it's time to explore your emotional intelligence. You may have heard something about emotional intelligence, or EI. The concept was coined by researchers Peter Salovey and John D. Mayer, who describe it as the subset of social intelligence that involves the ability to monitor one's own and others' feelings and emotions, to discriminate among them, and to use this information to guide one's thinking and actions. It was later made popular by psychologist Daniel Goleman, who published a best-selling book, Emotional Intelligence, in 1995. Goleman argued that IQ shouldn't be the sole measure of a person's abilities. Rather, their emotional awareness and intelligence also count. A lot. Goleman defines EI as the capacity for recognizing our own feelings and those of others, for motivating ourselves, and for managing emotions well in ourselves and in our relationships. EI is more about how you care about other people. Empathy is one of its core tenets. Everyone has a deep desire to be understood, to have their human needs being taken care, says Jason Gaynard, the founder of Mastermind Talks, an invitation-only event for entrepreneurs. Gaynard likens empathy to something the best marketers in the world can achieve. Terrible marketers are those who will talk about the product, about things that are inconsequential to the buyer. But the best marketers think and message with purpose. I always say that great marketers have the unique ability of putting themselves in the shoes of their prospects, he says. Understanding their wants, needs, desires, and fears, often better than they do. To be great at relationships, you need to do the same. Scott has personally experienced this sort of generosity. Not long after meeting a man named John Rulin for the first time, Scott was heading to a 3-day business trip to Nowhere, Michigan. Rulin is the co-founder and CEO of the Rulin Group and the author of Giftology. He and his team have created gift packages for some of the largest companies and pro sports teams in the world. Anything you want to know about gift giving? He's your guy. Scott's iPhone had crashed 2 weeks earlier, and the repair company had tried, and failed, to fix it 3 times. Now, Scott is tethered to his phone. He is on his phone for business 12 to 15 hours a day via email, phone, Slack, or other apps. It was worse than losing an arm or a leg. It was disabling and causing me stress like you wouldn't believe, says Scott. This isn't just a phone to me. It's my gateway to my entire business and network. The phone repair company had given him a temporary phone, an iPhone 4, which wasn't able to run a single app. The battery drained in 1 hour. When Rulin met him, Scott was a head case. I was at the end of my rope because the company fixing my phone just told me it might be another 2 weeks before I got my phone back, right after I had shipped it, when they originally told me 3 days, he says. But guess what? Rulin to the rescue. 15 hours later, when Scott opened the door to his hotel room in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, with a now-dead iPhone 4 to boot, there, along with a bottle of champagne and a handwritten note, was a brand-new iPhone 6 Plus, a personalized phone that was ready to be used immediately. Rulin, whom Scott had met only once before, had found out Scott's phone carrier and the hotel he was staying in from his assistant and overnighted him a loaner to be used until his own arrived. No fees, no surcharges, no deadline to return it. Scott couldn't believe it. "It shows he was not only listening to me," Scott recalls, "but understood a major pain point. I was like, this is impressive and so incredibly thoughtful. I'm never going to forget this." And he hasn't. Rulin shrugs it off. "It's fun for me to see what I can pull off and do," he says. "It's semi-addictive. It's fun when I can pull off the impossible." It was also emotionally intelligent. But you can't fake EI. As Jason Gaynard puts it, there are people who care and then people who genuinely care. The latter can't be faked, he says. You can't fake empathy or caring. You have to truly care about what you do. If you don't, you have to be honest and not pursue this type of relationship building. Picking your pond. It's not enough to be emotionally intelligent, though. You want to be aware of all the things that make you tick, including the sort of place you're comfortable inhabiting. Most people think you need to live in New York, L.A., or San Francisco with the titans of industry to build life-altering relationships. Wrong. You don't need to live in dense populations where you can meet a lot of people. The most self-aware and successful superconnectors root themselves in the places where they feel happiest and most stable. This is fundamental to having a satisfying life, but also a necessity if you want to build relationships with meaning and depth. A few years ago, Van Edwards moved from Los Angeles to Portland, Oregon. It was necessary. Bigger cities make her anxious. She knew that she couldn't thrive as a superconnector in a spread-out, impersonal place like L.A. So she left. At first, it was scary. She knew only one person in Portland. "I thought, I'll have no network," she recalls. She was wrong. In fact, her entire perspective on and approach to meeting people changed once she moved from a big pond to a small pond. Within a few months, it was bigger than her network in L.A., the city where she grew up. As a human behavior hacker, Van Edwards wanted to run a test. Could she, from scratch, grow her network to be bigger than her network in Los Angeles? She realized that for her, it was way better to be a big fish in a small pond. "I believe everyone has situations where they thrive and survive, and the key to strong networking is never putting yourself in survival situations," she says. "If you hate loud bars, don't put yourself in a situation like that." Beyond that, the self-described science geek cites something called the similarity attraction effect. The idea that people like to surround themselves with people like them. "Opposites attract" is a cliche not based in science, she says. Every time you have a mutuality, a commonality, you will attract each other. What this means is that if you are in a small pond, you're much more aware of that pond. Whereas people in Los Angeles may be somewhat, if not more, ambivalent about the place. In Portland, they are Oregonians, she says, enunciating each syllable for emphasis. So in every pond, you find a similarity. The cool thing is that all of us can fit into multiple ponds. We might not think of it that way, but we all have a host of arenas. Van Edwards, for example, is an entrepreneur. She is female. She is a social psychology expert. Right there are three groups she could join. And she did. As it happens, there was also a group in Portland for women entrepreneurs in technology. She hooked up with it, too. The right pond is the one where you are fascinated by everything in it, she says. Ryan is very much the same way. The minute he arrives at New York's Penn Station and hits 7th Avenue, the first thought to pop into his head is, "When can I go home?" He's just not a big city guy. When he and Scott first got serious building YEC, he knew that he wanted to move back east from Wisconsin. New York would have been a smart place to hang his hat. Scott was there. He, not surprisingly, thrives as a superconnector in big cities. But Ryan knew he wouldn't have the sense of stability and comfort he needed to let his own relationship-building prowess soar. Instead of moving to Manhattan, he chose Boston, a much smaller city where the entrepreneurial community felt more intimate and easy to navigate. Where you ultimately live determines how well you build strong relationships that will propel you forward in life. But if you're living in a place that gives you the hives, then you won't be successful or happy. If you're the kind of person who gets an adrenaline boost from a bustling metropolis like Manhattan, then that's where you should go. If you find comfort in a smaller city, then that's the place for you. We know superconnectors who live on rural farms in the Midwest because that's where they're the happiest. Anyone, anywhere, can be a superconnector. Who you are is ultimately more important than where you live. Curiosity. Curiosity is the engine that informs, leads, and inspires conversations. Superconnectors are extremely curious individuals. They care about learning, expanding their horizons, and getting as much information as they can from others in order to be helpful later on. They ask bucket loads of questions. If you're not a naturally curious person, and you're not naturally inquisitive, well, now's a good time to try to change that. It's really not that difficult. It's not like we're asking you to magically grow 5 inches. We're just asking you to be curious about the people you are talking to ask some questions, and to shut up and listen. Listening is probably the most critical trait for anyone who wants to become a superconnector, since you're the one reaching out to the potential connection, says Keith Ferrazzi. Curiosity about someone other than yourself is also important. Okay, fine. But what if you truly are not interested in how the world works? Hard to imagine, we know, but some people really aren't. Can you develop curiosity? In his book, Curious, The Desire to Know and Why Your Future Depends on It, author Ian Leslie offers an array of tips on how to become curious. Suggestions include going to a real-life bookstore or library. There are some left, thankfully. And getting lost in the shelves. Reading everything you can get your hands on a wide swath of subjects, and not solely relying on Google for information. Final thought. If you're not a naturally curious person, fear not. If you can train yourself to ask a lot of questions, you won't be at a disadvantage. We will go into deep detail in Chapter 8 about what makes a good question, as well as what questions really suck. But what's important to note here is that a curious person doesn't usually accept the first response to a question as the answer. Instead, they just see it as the outer layer. Good questions have answers that are like layers of an onion. You can continue to peel them away. The deeper you go with follow-up questions leads to layers with more depth and value than the layers before. For example, you might be satisfied by the simple exospheric answer to the question, "What do you do?" For example, "I'm project manager for XYZ company." If that's the case, your curiosity levels might need some help. The deeper, more meaningful nuggets of information lie in layers beneath that you can access by asking follow-up questions. For instance, what do you like the most about your job? What's one exciting thing you're working on right now? What challenges about your work are keeping you up at night? What types of opportunities are you looking for beyond what you're currently doing? Moving past the basics and into an area with more depth and substance is what separates a simple networker from someone with superconnector potential. Remember this the next time you're meeting someone new. Dig a little deeper and flex your curiosity muscles. Chapter 4. The Art of Selectivity. People notice the company you keep. for better or for worse, whom we surround ourselves with is a reflection of who we are. So you want to make sure that you surround yourself with folks you admire and respect, who can set the tone for the whole foundation. You don't just haphazardly build a network with anyone who will communicate with you. You want to find people who will have influence over the group. People who believe what you believe and buy into your thesis. People who are already connected in the circles that are meaningful to them. Superconnectors are selective in everything they do. The time they manage, the company they keep, the people they put around them. It doesn't mean you are a snob and that you think you are better than everyone else. It just means you're cognizant of your time. We are all busy. We're all trying to manage our time effectively. While you could give your time to 50 people, you would most likely make less of an impact than if you focused your energy on 5 people, especially 5 people who can become your zealots and take your mission to another 5 people, and so on and so forth. Superconnectors are some of the most focused people we know. They hone their actions keenly. Dara Brustein founded Network Under 40 after a friend who had recently finished college and was working at an international law firm in Atlanta, where Brustein was living, complained that all of her friends had scattered around the country. She didn't really have a social circle anymore, and she didn't know what to do about it. Brustein racked her brain, trying to think of events where her friend could meet genuine people. She couldn't think of anything, so she did it herself. The first event was Electric, with 94 people, 90 of whom were friends of Brustein's. So she continued throwing these events, and they grew into hundreds of attendees each month and soon got national press. People requested she throw similar events in their cities. So she did. Brustein is well aware that you can add meaningful value to only a select group of people before the frequency with which you're able to provide value diminishes. You can't develop relationships or help other people develop them if you're not who you really are, she says. You need to be able to present an authentic version of yourself, and the right people will resonate with it and gravitate toward you. That does not mean you have to get along with everyone or become everyone's best friend. You can statistically have only X number of relationships, like 5 close ones, 50 secondary ones, and about 150 tertiary ones, and then everyone else falls into a big old pool, she says. So she often does a little relationship housekeeping. It's important to consider the 5 people who are in your inner circle, because they are going to deeply and profoundly influence you, she says. It's important to know that the way people view you from the outside is going to have a lot to do with the people with whom you're surrounding yourself. So be sure not only that they're life-giving for you, but also that they help you to be a bigger and better version of yourself simply because they're motivating just based on who they are. But remember, too, that people are going to draw snap and instant judgments of you based on this circle, so make sure that you're selecting wisely. Your intention doesn't have to be anything radical, by the way. In 2006, Elliot Bisnow was a 20-year-old college student at the University of Wisconsin with no mentor and no network. And he wanted them desperately. So he found 20 young entrepreneurs who were doing really cool things and called them out of the blue. He invited them on an all-expenses-paid ski trip to Alta, Utah, which his mother helped him plan. All of these people were up-and-comers. Josh Abramson and Ricky Van Veen had not yet founded College Humor. Blake Mikoski had not yet turned Tom's Shoes into an empire. All Bisnow knew was that they were people he wanted to know. Before Bisnow's first ski trip, he had one goal: to get 20 interesting, kind, good people together, with the intention of getting half a dozen great new relationships out of it. He got that, and then some. Those original people invited people on the second trip, who then invited people for the third trip, and so on. The community kept getting bigger. Today, there are thousands of people in what he called the Summit Series. Now, just Summit. Admittedly, the idea of curating people the way you would some artifact in the Louvre sounds kind of obnoxious. On the other hand, you have to think about the sorts of people you want to surround yourself with. There is power in association. Bisno defines it as lifestyle design. That is, giving thought to whom you're going to spend time with. Are you going to create a life where you eat fast food and work later hours and your family comes second? Where you have characters in your life who are not a good influence? Or are you going to surround yourself where health and wellness happen every day, and the people around you care about the world and planet? It's picking your friends and where you live and what you eat and how you live intentionally. Incidentally, exclusivity has never been a word he has used. He prefers self-selecting. We are just trying to get people who are really kind and passionate about the world together, he says. I don't think that criterion is exclusive. Any person can self-select into it. To some people, selectivity means being exclusive in the form of a structured, formal group. To others, it could be the company you keep. You don't have to be everybody's best friend. So how do you separate those you want to invest in from those you don't? Mitch Kanner, the founder and CEO of 2Degrees, a company that connects brands with people of influence to create cultural moments, agrees. Kanner has been credited with discovering the opportunity, connecting the parties, and causing the release of Jay-Z's Magna Carta Holy Grail album with 1 million Samsung phone owners. He was once named to Advertising Age's list of hottest Rolodexes, but he's totally under the radar. He isn't interested in notoriety. He's interested in results. Nurture those people whom you are able to execute unique, strategic, big ideas with, and in success develop long-term trusted relationships with, because real relationships last, Kanner notes. From a business perspective, those same people grow and evolve and continue to collaborate with you. It's all about trust and famous ideas that work. Kanner prides himself on working with a select cadre of significant clients rather than a large, impersonal group. He mostly operates on principles that include talent, personality, ability to execute, partnership, and intelligence. Does he have anything in common with them as people? Are they good people? And no matter what, never, ever compromise your values, even if it puts you in a potentially negative situation with someone. That is, you are creating your own world around you. You get to decide how people should interact with each other. You decide the rules of engagement. And that, in turn, determines how you build your community. You get to decide with whom you spend your precious time, building hands-on, deep relationships. But don't overextend yourself by trying to connect with too many people and doing too many things at once. This is a mistake many would-be superconnectors make. By keeping that inner circle small, you'll be surprised how much more good you'll be able to do for the larger community of people in the world who care about the same things that you do. Obviously, not everyone has a mountain at their disposal to help curate an elite community that makes for a superconnector's fantasy. Let these stories of people like Bisno and others inspire you, but please don't hold yourself to the same standards. Start curating and leveraging the art of selectivity in your own world with a simple assessment. First, assess yourself. Ask, am I in control of the relationships I have in my life, or am I giving that control to others? If the latter, how can I take the power back? And, more important, how will I use that power once I have it back in my possession? This starts by determining what selectivity should look like in your life. Who is deserving of your time and why? Equally as important, who's not? If I don't control most or all of my time, why do I feel the need to follow the lead of others? Can I take that power back immediately or slowly? Why or why not? If something is stopping me from controlling my own time, can I put a plan in place to lessen my time investment until I fully withdraw from such a person, commitment, or activity? Next, assess your habits and activities. What activities did I take part in over the past week? What was worth my time? What wasn't? What would I definitely do again or invest more time in? What would I cut entirely? Finally, assess others. Who did you spend your time with over the past week? Who was worth your time? Who wasn't? Based on the people you've met with this past week, what types of people do you definitely want to invest more of your time in? What types of people do you want to cut entirely? For each of these exercises, you can create a simple two-column chart. In one column, write down your traits and the traits of the people and activities you enjoyed investing time in. For example, ambitious, in my industry, valuable insights, and the like. In the other column, write down your traits and the traits of the people and activities you didn't enjoy investing time in. For example, not in my industry, wanted to watch movies all night, and so on. This will help you weed out the people you don't want and focus more on the ones you do. What's your authentically authentic thesis? Your thesis is what you stand for, who you are, and what you believe in. Ideally, you should be able to utter all this in two sentences. Knowing this will help you define your goals. You want to understand why you do the things you do. What do you care about, and why do you care about the things you care about? What do you want to be known for? Not only can't the majority of people talk about themselves in a smart and interesting fashion, but they aren't sure what they're trying to accomplish in their work lives either. They read a business book that tells them to do content marketing and create a personal brand in XYZ subject area, so they do it, or hire someone else to do it, and expect the world to come to them. This is ass backward. What's more, people know when you are being insincere. They can smell it from 100 miles away. They know when you are doing something that doesn't come from a genuine place. Indeed, there's a huge difference between strategically deciding, I'm going to be authentic, and having someone else say, now that is one authentic person. Your goal should be not to promote your own authenticity, but to pass other people's authenticometer. You want external authenticity and internal authenticity. You want to be authentically authentic. Steve Sims, 50, is the CEO of The Bluefish, the world's most successful concierge, in his words. As he puts it, I'm the guy who gets stuff done. In his opinion, authenticity is a new fucking t-shirt. Networking has become the dirtiest word in business. You have to come to people with rawness, with what your message is. People can tell if you are genuine just from your intent and tone of voice. If you're off-putting and just doing the bare minimum, it's obvious. You know when you're having a real conversation instead of a superficial one, right? If you recall, part of the reason we linked up is because we both wanted to help young entrepreneurs like us. We both wanted to help them get access to better people and resources. And thus, YEC was born. We are convinced that entrepreneurs came knocking because our thesis resonated in everything we wrote, tweeted, and posted, as well as how we spent our free time volunteering. We had clear values we wanted to espouse. Virtues. We didn't just write about them or talk about them with the press. We lived them. We cared deeply about what we were talking about. The point, though, is that our expertise grew from an organic place. We didn't start out focusing on keywords and taglines to get better search engine optimization. It happened naturally, genuinely, growing from years of patience and consistency, because those who are transactional and sporadic will lose in the end. We practiced what we preached. We were hands-on and mentored other people. We launched a campaign to push a bill through Congress that would help ease youth unemployment and rallied other entrepreneurs, thought leaders, and politicians to get behind it. We even tried to get Stephen Colbert to give it the Colbert Bump, a national campaign that received tremendous support from our audience. It didn't work, alas, but we have hope that he's hearing about it here and will come to his senses. But while we, humbly, acknowledge that we're good at what we do, we don't believe that a brazen attitude alone made us who we are today. It was the work we put in and our genuine care for that work. We didn't just talk a good talk. We backed it up with real action. If neither one of us cared about young entrepreneurs or Gen Y, whatever we wrote or said would have come off as empty, hollow, and insincere. People would have seen right through us, and they would have been right. The moral of the story? Don't try to be something you're not. That was something Allison Esposito, the founder of Tech Ladies, which connects women with the best jobs in tech, kept in mind when she was building her community. Esposito recognized that women in technology needed a safe space. Her idea was to scale kindness. She had experienced sexual harassment and gender discrimination during her career. She wondered, how can we build solutions and use networking and the power of a group of people to make the experience of working in tech as a woman better? As Tech Ladies started growing, she started to feel a sense of security that she'd never had in her career. I thought, you know, if something really bad happens that's out of my control, I have a couple of hundred people right now that I could talk to and network with and lean on for my next job, she says. That started to feel like the first job security I'd had in my career, and that's what really drew me in. Today, Tech Ladies has 15,000 members. With a well-crafted purpose, you can define which relationships matter most for you to cultivate, learn how to create the foundation for those relationships, and decide how you will maintain them over time. Chapter 5. The Power of Association. Superconnectors know what questions to ask. They also tend to be great listeners. But they sometimes like to have someone by their side, another person to bounce things off of. We call them our anchors. But for now, it might be helpful to think of them as a connector's connector. A large part of what made YEC so valuable was that from early on, we had compiled a small group of people who understood our mission. To create a small sphere of people willing to let their guard down and share and support one another in a professional capacity. When we opened it up and grew that community through referrals, it took on a life of its own. Members we helped with connections or visibility in the press would naturally tell their entrepreneurial peers, and so on. We called those people our anchors. And they are basically trusted advisors and the foundation on which any successful community is built. The bedrock. Long-term connections who will always be there for you. Anchors are so important because they are your gateway to meet other amazing people and set the stage for what others will think of you. An anchor can be anyone from a group organizer, whether for-profit or non-profit, to an advisor, to a friend or family member. It doesn't matter who they are. More important is that they're the cornerstone of whatever it is you want to do. They have both short-term potential, introducing you to people, offering you association to further progress your relationship building, and long-term potential, exponentially building out and maintaining your network with your remaining at the center. When we first started YEC, for example, we only had about 30 members. The idea was to build the foundation and grow it from there. If you can create something special that people care about, if, say, you have 5 or 10 real estate investors who are amassing high-level information from each other, that's infinitely more valuable than putting them in touch with 8,000 people. It's important to assemble people who you believe are going to buy into what you're going to do for the collective. You also want to provide constant and consistent training so that they're able to run with the torch themselves once the comfort level has been achieved. Why? Because you cannot scale you. You can't be everywhere at once. So you want people, ambassadors, who will be able to do this themselves, so they feel ownership. Superconnectors associate with these anchors to fill in the gaps between their weaknesses and strengths, as well as for credibility and the value of association. Your anchors help you demonstrate to others the company you keep. They also enable you to meet other people more fluidly from other people's networks. If you're introverted, this might mean you'd work with an extrovert to pull you out of your shell. If you're extroverted, it might mean being with someone who helps bring you back down to earth and connect you with introverts you want to meet who might otherwise be shaken by your super outgoing personality type. An anchor gives credibility and value and shows that by association, the person is legit. It's the idea that when you get into a circle of the most powerful people on earth, if you're being brought in by an insider who already has a track record, trust, and relationships, you have instant credibility. Doesn't matter if it's a major circle or a small, intimate gathering of local professionals. Over the years, we have each met amazing people because we act as each other's anchors. Sure, Scott, the ultimate extrovert, has introduced people to Ryan. But Ryan has also introduced people to Scott, specifically other introverts who are valuable to know, who may have been intimidated to meet Scott and would have shied away from the more traditional places where Scott meets people, like any large social gathering. The fact that Ryan knows them instantly gives Scott credibility, and vice versa. But anchors aren't only personality-driven. An anchor could also simply be someone who can pull you into their world to break the ice. Incidentally, Jason Gaynard of Mastermind Talks did not start out as a superconnector. His goal was to gather people together for a remarkable experience with huge social influence. He trusted his network to do its job and introduce only the people who are meaningful to him. "I believe you can get credibility through association," he says. Gaynard came to his new vocation in a rather interesting way. In August 2011, he attended an event called Opening the Kimono, run by best-selling author Tim Ferriss of 4-Hour Workweek fame. It was geared toward authors and cost $10,000 a pop. Was it worth it to spend $10,000? Actually, yes. Gaynard was surrounded by brilliant thinkers and business people, and he got a chance to meet Ferriss in person. It opened my eyes to the value of the idea that if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room, he says. I was definitely in over my head. He invited Ferriss to come speak in Canada in May 2013, which became the very first Mastermind Talk. Gaynard could not pay speakers, but he already had Ferriss on deck, and people wanted in. Through that association, he landed other well-known names, such as authors and entrepreneurs Ryan Holiday and Lewis Howes. 5 other people whom he'd also met at the 2011 Kimono event also signed on. Going into that first event, I had no credibility, but having the credibility of Tim and Ryan rubbed off on me, Gaynard says. You might be surprised who your wingmen and wingwomen turn out to be. The Pyramid of Influence. We've been told that the highest paid executives, or the ones with the most press recognition, are the key people to meet. But if you ask most of them whom they trust, you probably wouldn't know any of the people they mention. Most of their influencers are under the radar. Superconnectors understand who the right people to connect with are. Those who impact other people's decisions and ideas. We think of it as a pyramid of influence. At the top of the pyramid is the person you want to reach. Most people's instinct is to zip right up the pyramid and reach out directly to that person. Why waste time with anyone else? Ah, but here's the thing. In order to reach him or her, you want to go lower on the pyramid. Those are the people who are the influencers, the ones who have unfettered access to the person in charge. That could be their spouse or assistant. Imagine you want to meet Richard Branson. It's unlikely that he's going to be interested in meeting you. Not because you're lame, but because he gets so many requests. Rather than going right to him, you should go to someone lower on the totem pole. Keith Ferrazzi acknowledged this issue in a widely read blog post, How I Avoided the Receiving Line and Met Hillary Clinton, which was published on LinkedIn on May 1st, 2015. At the time of their meeting, way back in the 1990s, Clinton was first lady and Ferrazzi was the chief marketing officer, CMO, of Starwood Hotels. He had gone to an event where she was the keynote speaker. Afterward, the place was jammed with people set on meeting her. While the masses were clamoring for Hillary's attention, Ferrazzi noticed a woman standing off to the side. Every so often, she spoke directly to Hillary. Aha! She was not some random woman whispering into the First Lady's ear. She was Clinton's executive assistant, whom he calls Kelly. Ferrazzi started chatting her up, finding out about her life and her family. When he learned she was taking a vacation, he offered her a free upgrade for her accommodations. From an early age, I've keenly understood the criticality of maintaining warm relationships with those who manage the lives of important people, so we stayed in touch, he says. I'd reach out to Kelly regularly, offering whatever value I could, and I'd never ask for favors from her boss since my friendship at that time wasn't with the First Lady. It was with the woman who controlled much of her schedule and time. When Clinton and Kelly came through Southern California, where Ferrazzi lived, he offered to make introductions that the team might want or need during their time off, which, of course, they did not have. Finally, thanks to his relational capital with her office, Ferrazzi was invited to an exclusive event where he finally got the chance to meet Hillary face to face. He made such an impression on her that he was invited to the White House for the Clintons' last Christmas in office. When he ran into her years later at the Clinton Global Initiative, she remembered him well enough to ask about his kids. The moral of the story is this. When developing relationships, it's always best to look not just at the people you want to know, but at those around them. Their staff aren't just gatekeepers. Often, they are lifeline relationships as well, he says. When you're of service to their confidants and generous to them, you're being of service to them. Thought leaders, business leaders, major politicians, all need strong, loyal staff members to keep them up to date and on track. Any help you provide is noticed and ripples out. The key is to be patient and to understand that the more you establish yourself as an ally and a friend to your contact staff, the more you'll be seen as a crucial member of a team and part of that person's inner circle, he says. Now, you may not be in a position to meet the First Lady, but the principle still applies to other people. Let's take it down a few notches. In a small town, who is the person who's got his fingers on the pulse of almost everything? That's usually someone in a professional service position, like a lawyer, accountant, or someone who serves group organizers or nonprofits in a business capacity. There are many, and most are highly qualified. However, the most successful attorneys and professionals are also very well connected. It's also easier to get their attention when you're first starting out. Say you are a top-tier attorney. Your key to success is to be highly connected to the business community in town. You constantly need to meet people. By default, if you are the most reputable in town and seen as the best at what you do, then you are a connector. That said, you shouldn't just go and meet every accountant you can. But there are a select few who truly have access in almost every business ecosystem. Ryan lives in Quincy, Massachusetts, a suburban city right outside of Boston. This is where he is raising his family. He plans on staying there for a long time. He cares a lot about seeing the town prosper and thinks that the current government isn't getting the job done fast enough. He's been looking for ways to get involved and support the town he is so invested in. So where did he start? With a trip to the mayor's office. By looking for groups of people who felt the same way that I did about making change in Quincy, he says. His first connection was a lawyer he was sitting next to at a bar in downtown Boston. They struck up a conversation. "Where do you live?" Ryan asked. "Quincy," she replied. "Hey, me too. Do you like living there?" "Not bad, but I feel like they need to catch up with the rest of Boston," she said. "I'm working with some people to help push some changes." Boom, he found his in. He was invited to attend a fundraiser for a new candidate for mayor and started finding new ways in which he could get involved and support the changes he wanted to see in his community. There is no magic here, just a little strategy. In this case, Google is your best friend. In a LinkedIn culture, you can find out just about anything you need to know about a person that's not confidential or private. And you might even learn that too. It's the first place we go to see who is connected to whom and to do research on someone. Who knows? Maybe you have commonalities. The gift that keeps on giving. Rulin wasn't always a gifting guru. It came to him organically. He was in college studying to be a doctor and interned at Cutco, a cutlery, kitchen knives, and accessories company, to learn sales. One day, he noticed that Paul, the father of a girl he was dating, sent clients an extraordinary number of knives. But he didn't send them just to clients. He also sent knives to their spouses and business associates. I was like, "You're going to give a bunch of grown men kitchen knives? That's the weirdest thing in the world," Rulin recalls. Paul saw the look on my face. He said, "If you do something for the inner circle, everything else in business seems to take care of itself." At that moment, I realized that Paul understood relationship building at a depth I did not. So Rulin began doing that too, spending $200 on a Cutco carving set and engraving the names of the executives he wanted to meet, and their wives, and sending the knives to them, which then got him the meetings with the CEOs. He was, mind you, 22 years old. The CEOs he met with, who were worth $100 million, were expecting a gray-haired executive. Instead, they got a spry young buck. But he would land the deal, becoming the largest seller in the country. Rulin realized that he had such a gift for gifting that he decided to quit med school and open a gift-giving company. He soon became a sought-after speaker on marketing and relationship building. Knowing how and when to give gifts is just as important as what to give. Most people give gifts around a holiday, say Thanksgiving or Christmas. Usually, it's a bottle of wine or fruit basket. That does not fly with Rulin. "I don't spend one dime on gifting between Thanksgiving and Christmas because that's the obligatory time. If you want to connect with people, you want to do it just as a surprise. We call it planned randomness." He takes his planned randomness very seriously. In fact, he reinvests 5 to 10% of his company's profits back into his relationships. By standing out from the crowd and being remarkable, you'll get noticed. It's not that the gift is so much better than anything anyone else sends during the normal time period, but because you are doing the opposite of what is expected. And that is precisely why he stood out. Rather than send a generic bottle of wine or knife set, Rulin engraved his client's name on it, along with the client's wife's name. Not his company name, theirs. "There's never our company name or logo or brand," he says. "Otherwise, it's a promotional product. It's swag. And most people confuse what a gift is and what a marketing tool. As a gift, it's about the recipient, not about you." He won't send anything consumable unless it's paired with something that's not. The rationale? "If they're thinking about me 15 years later, then I win," he says. Top of mind matters. Most people try to remain top of mind with things that are fleeting, but we want people to have something they can use 30 years from now. And the practicality of it is important. Every time they use it, the psychology of reciprocity is really powerful. Most people have in their DNA the pressure to reciprocate. People will take my call 10 years later. It plants a seed that doesn't go away. Not only does he send personalized gifts, but he also sends gifts to people who wouldn't expect to get one. Like, say, the CEO's assistant. "If someone sends something I can give to my wife, they get me in the process," he says. "If they make me look cool to my wife and assistant, that's a done deal." People don't realize that it's the people around them or decision makers two executives down who are the most important. These are the people at the top of our pyramid of influence. The snowblower effect. We are fans of surprising and delighting people whenever possible. We like to think of it as the kinder, gentler version of shock and awe. Every so often, totally at random, we will surprise and delight one of our community members with something completely unexpected. We might send a book that could help them with a project we know they're working on, or we'll leave an encouraging message for someone we haven't talked to in a while just to check in. This serves three purposes. It makes people feel really good to know that there are people out there thinking about them. And it makes us feel good to make them feel good. But also, by offering unexpected value to the people who matter most to us, we are remaining relevant. Every time you surprise and delight someone, we are using these words as verbs, it enables you to remain top of mind. Steve Sims is 100% in agreement. Sims recalls the client who was interested in exclusive access to Disney. Sims vaguely knew someone who could help him with this request. As it happens, Sims's contact, the one who might have been able to help him, also desperately craved a Porsche. Unfortunately, the contact's wife put the kibosh on this idea. In her opinion, the last thing her husband needed was a new Porsche. So Sims, who was born in East London and has the street smarts of a kid born in East London, decided to take matters into his own hands. He sent both this guy and his wife to an exclusive Porsche driving experience to test out cars. As Sims suspected, the wife fell madly in love with the car and relented. Her husband was more than welcome to buy his Porsche. "It cost me $950 for the Porsche driving experience," says Sims. "I can tell you quite openly, the price my client paid for the exclusive access to Disney that this man helped me with was 10 times that." A win-win all around. Not only was his client happy, and Sims got paid handsomely, but Sims also ensured that he would remain in his newfound contact's brain. "I'm embedded in his head," says Sims. "Every time they drive the Porsche, they're thinking of this guy from London." Exactly. Scott calls this the snowblower effect, which came about as the result of an experience he had not long after moving to the New Jersey suburbs in 2015. As we know, Scott is a friendly sort, the kind of guy whom everyone usually knows. But after moving to New Jersey, he realized he knew no one in his neighborhood. Then winter came, and snow blanketed the town on a repeated basis. Scott dutifully plowed his own driveway. Then he did the neighbors' driveways on each side of him. But why stop there? By the end of the day, Scott had eradicated snow from neighbors on streets in multiple directions. He became the hero of his town, but he also snagged a place in the hearts of all residents. They were ecstatic and surprised that someone would be so thoughtful. Not only did he get to know his entire block, but any time he and his family needed anything, his neighbors were the first to lend a hand. Teach someone to fish. You have probably heard a lot of talk on the value of having a mentor, but you may not have thought about it the way a superconnector would. By asking for help and guidance, and then living up to and exceeding your mentor's expectations, you can grow your social capital exponentially. Your mentors will take you under their wings and bring you into their various circles, like an anchor, in a sense. Just ask Jared Kleinert. Jared became an entrepreneur at the ripe old age of 15. He admits that when he was trying to build his first company, he made every single business mistake you can think of. Imagine. But the biggest cardinal sin that I made was having the wrong people around me and having a poor mentor, he says. Indeed, his mentor at the time was a man he discovered had served time in prison for securities fraud on Wall Street. No fool, Kleinert quickly realized that it would behoove him to surround himself with better people than former white-collar con men. If you're going to have a mentor, don't make it a bad one, he says wryly. Not long after, Jared, now 16, happened upon an article in Forbes called The Most Connected Man You Don't Know in Silicon Valley. It was about David Hassel, founder and CEO of 15five, an enterprise software startup based in San Francisco. Kleinert was intrigued. What struck me about David and how he connected others was not only that all these people went out of their way to hang out with him and to join him at events he put on, but that they also had real change that came into their lives as a result of David, he says. It was obvious to Jared that David was the type of person he aspired to be like, and so he wrote him a thoughtful, cold email, just like that. Boom. After a few back and forths, Kleinert offered to work unpaid in exchange for his mentorship. At 16, the only value I could provide really was my time and my energy, he says. I made it easy for David to say yes. Kleinert then shaped that role into the dream internship he imagined for himself and went from unpaid intern to one of the company's first 10 team members. He ultimately helped develop their outbound sales system after some 2 years of trying almost every other role in the company that didn't involve punching code or executive functions. But the story doesn't end there. While working for 15five, Jared met other connectors and learned how to become one himself. For example, I grew up in South Florida, he says. There's this guy, Ibn Pagan, who's one of the top internet marketers of all time. He's sold more than $100 million worth of information products online and has helped many others to do the same or similar. Ibn was hosting a high-ticket, high-impact conference in Miami that was an hour from where Kleinert grew up. David was attending. I went to meet David at the cocktail reception. I wasn't yet able to go to the event, but I joined this cocktail reception. I ended up meeting Ibn and a couple of other people in the room whom I still know today. A few months later, Ibn was hosting the same event in Sedona, Arizona. He graciously invited me to join that event. I said yes. When I went to Ibn's event in Sedona, I met another 50 or 100 other superconnectors because Ibn understands this principle. He was not only surrounding himself with superconnectors, but also charging them $6,000 to get into his event. And everyone was very happy to pay him that. I went. At that event, among other individuals I met, was Neil Strauss, who is a New York Times best-selling author. You can imagine what transpired. Kleinert became pals with Strauss. Through a dinner party Strauss threw in